so you all laugh out. And if you know me, know you shut your ass mouth. I bet somebody over here
tell you. We have 1 minute to go. After I was going to take over. 1 minute
to go. CKUT is going online for our 2020 annual general meeting. Join us on Monday, November 23rd at 6 p.m. to hear how your favorite community radio station has been adapting to the current pandemic by broadcasting remotely. To find out how you can get involved in one of our various committees, to propose a motion, or find out more information about joining our Board of Governors, email culture@ckut.ca. That's culture@ckut.ca. Monday, November 23rd at 6 p.m. online, CKUT's annual general meeting. To RSVP for the event, email agm@ckut.ca. That's agm@ckut.ca. Hope to see you there.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to Labor Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is one of your co-hosts, Mustafa Henaway.
And I'm Stefan Doucet. Welcome to the show for November. We got a great show for you this month, always coming to you on the third Thursday of the month, 5 to 6 p.m. We got a couple interviews. Do you want to introduce the first one, Mustafa?
Yeah, so the first interview that we got this month, as many people know, in the United States, but now it's become a global phenomenon, Black Friday and Cyber Monday, the two largest shopping days of the year, puts, you know, the invisible work of people at Amazon and other warehouses and distribution centers, people at the choke points, at the epicenter of the global economy. And so today we actually have a special interview. One of them related on the themes of warehouse work is Christian Smalls, who was an Amazon worker in New Jersey, who was fired for organizing a walkout of Amazon workers during the COVID pandemic over lack of measures protecting workers and Amazon's incompetency in the warehouse. Chris Smalls has become a symbol, I think, of the struggle at Amazon and the challenges. He remains active for Black Lives Matter and as well as pursuing Amazon both in the courts, but also politically to organize Amazon workers, even though he no longer is there.
Right. And second interview today will be with David Bergeron-Cyr of the Fédération du Commerce of the CSN. We're going to talk about the lockout at Jean Coutu that will lasted over a month and actually just ended they went back to work on Monday this week, I believe, after voting 78% in favor of the new contract proposed by the consignatrice. So we'll talk with him about that conflict and sort of in general what's looking like in the commercial sector of CSN, because that was neither the first nor the last sort of important conflict involved in that federation within the CSN. So looking forward to that conversation. But before we take you there, we just wanted to mention a few other big stories in the labor movement in Quebec and Canada and internationally that caught our attention. Moose.
Yeah, there's a lot happening in the world of working people this past month, but especially here in Quebec. I mean, one of the big things that that has come up that really shows sort of the kind of the new fault lines is that unfortunately the Canadian Labour Congress has endorsed officially Bill Morneau, the former Liberal Party finance minister, to be the head of the OECD or Organization Economic Cooperation and Development, which brings together the most advanced capitalist economies in the world. And Bill Morneau's no friend of working people or of trade unions. You know, he's someone who's been highly criticized in terms of his free trade policies. He's also taken very direct anti-union measures as well in dealing with the public sector.
Yeah, it was a real head scratcher. I think like the reaction of the labor movement in Canada, even sort of the most kind of cautious big unions was actually fairly quick and decisive. I mean, they haven't retracted their endorsement as far as I know, but many big unions, obviously the Canadian Union of Postal Workers was right out front against it, but even PSAC and lots of QPs, and anyways, the reaction was quick. And but it definitely, I think it made people also not just react, but also reflect in terms of how that these decisions are made and what it means about the state of the Canadian Labour Congress in general.
Yeah, I mean, he's somewhat in, you know, with the postal workers in the 2018 denied their right to, you know, collective bargaining and forced back to work legislation. He was someone who went after the steel workers directly, you know, and cut people's benefits during COVID. So, I mean, he is someone that it's very unfortunate. I mean, to see that the CLC leadership, I mean, it's clear that they're more and more opting to seek favor within the Liberal Party and moving away from the NDP, but it's a big step in the wrong direction. The backlash also shows that maybe there's hope also that unions are are now seeing a kind of a, you know, that there's a very stark choice that they can make.
Absolutely. Other big stories, we don't have much time to get into them, but those big wildcat strikes in the Albertan health sector after the announcement of massive job cuts during a pandemic, which might seem counterintuitive, except that is how the right governs, and they govern pretty decisively, and labor has to respond decisively. In this case, it was through illegal strikes. So hats off to them and the healthcare workers in Alberta standing strong. Here in Quebec, public sector negotiations are continuing. There was the occupation of the Conseil du Trésor by CSN activists. I think in general, the public sector negotiations are going pretty terribly. And so the unions are sort of stepping up their methods and their pressure tactics and their media tactics and so on. They even announced that they're going to block a bridge in Trois-Rivières. So looking forward to that kind of militant activity here in Quebec.
Also, and is also the introduction of the new health and safety law, or the modernization of the health and safety law, which quite, while many groups have denounced, you know, a lot of what's in the law, there's also some gains for workers to extend health and safety committees that would be elected by workers to all workplaces. But unfortunately, like other corporatist models, there'll be equal representation of employers and workers. So unfortunately, it doesn't give workers the ability to trump employers, but at least it allows for workers to begin to organize in workplaces for better health and safety without repercussions by management. But at the same time, there's major cuts to actual benefits to workers as a result, saying that they're going to make workplaces safer so that there will be less need for compensation. So this makes it very difficult for workers who do get injured.
Absolutely. And so being that it's a provincial law that will be, that's being proposed by a majority government, they can actually push it through like they've pushed through other like very unpopular legislation. So we'll have to watch the reaction of the labor movement, but also of the nonprofit sector that works around injured workers, like the UTAM here in Montreal, who were out right away in opposition to the law. And so I would say people should watch their reaction as well, because this is sort of their wheelhouse. And so they have the expertise that and the time to dedicate to it that some unions might not actually, because they have so many other things on the table.
And moving to a bit of international news, and the class struggle beyond the confines of Turtle Island, which Stefan is more abreast to. So,
sure, yeah. Well, just an exciting development in Turkey was the Communist Party of Turkey deciding that they were going to start a militant trade union with the historic mandate of communist parties, which is organizing the unorganized. The name of their campaign was Breathing Down the Boss's Neck. So hoping that they have lots of success with that. And then otherwise also, we're quite possibly going to be interviewing someone very shortly on the coming general strike in India, which is November 26th. That was the location of the biggest worldwide general strike ever. Last year or the year before. And so hopefully we'll be hearing from someone real soon on that, and we'll be able to give you that content in December after the strike. But people should check out news coming out of there, because that's very exciting. I feel like we should leave it at that so that we have time for our interviews that we announced earlier on. Anything to add, Mustafa?
I mean, no, just, sit back and, enjoy Labor Radio here on CKT 90.3 FM, and we'll get into the nitty-gritty of the choke points of capitalism and how workers are resisting.
Absolutely. Stay tuned. On est content d'être avec David Bergeron-Cyr de la Fédération du commerce de la CSN. On va parler notamment du conflit de travail à Jean Coutu, mais aussi possiblement aussi de d'autres sujets. Merci d'avoir pris le temps de nous rencontrer aujourd'hui, David.
Merci, bien, ça fait plaisir.
Bon, fait qu'on va commencer, on va parler de Jean Coutu. Fait que brièvement, pour ceux qui sont moins au courant de ce conflit-là, pourrais-tu nous donner là, un bref survol de la question? Qu'est-ce qui s'est passé? Pourquoi?
Oui, bien, Jean Coutu, c'est le centre de distribution là, qui emploie dans l'entrepôt environ 700 travailleurs syndiqués. Puis, il faut savoir, là, Jean Coutu a été acheté récemment par Metro, là, ce qui a changé beaucoup de choses aussi. Puis, il y a 3 ans, on était dans un autre centre de distribution qui était vieillot, et c'est rien que des racking puis des lifts, là, qui était situé à Longueuil. À l'époque, on n'était pas encore acheté par Metro, mais quand l'entrepôt a déménagé dans un nouveau centre hyper moderne, puis que quand Metro a acheté Jean Coutu, bien, a acquéri en même temps ce centre de distribution-là qui est rendu hyper automatisé, mécanisé. Quatrième révolution, là, il y en a plein là-dedans. Là, t'sais, fait que ça je vous explique ça parce que quand ça a commencé, ça, il y a 3 ans, ça a créé beaucoup d'insatisfaction auprès des travailleurs parce que quand ils sont arrivés dans un nouvel entrepôt, bien, le boss s'est mis à ne pas respecter la convention collective, puis surtout qu'il y en avait même des bouts de toute façon qui ne s'appliquaient plus. Fait que ça a été extrêmement compliqué. Puis dans les 3 dernières années, il y a eu beaucoup de grogne, beaucoup de frustration qui étaient accumulées par les membres du syndicat, puis que le syndicat a canalisé pour finalement déboucher sur un rapport de force puis une solidarité quand on a commencé la négociation. Puis évidemment, le fait qu'on ait été acheté par Metro, le fait qu'on avait un entrepôt hyper moderne que tu peux justement pas délocaliser comme que ça aurait été le cas. Si ça avait été la vieille shop à Longueuil, là, je vous le dis, là, on serait fermé. C'est aussi simple que ça. Il aurait fermé parce que quand c'est rien que des racking, des produits puis des lifts, là, c'est pas bien compliqué. Mais là, avec le niveau d'automatisation puis d'investissement de robotisation qu'il y a là-dedans, là, c'est plus la même ballgame. Fait que, on avait des demandes ambitieuses, autant au niveau du normatif, pas pour là, je fais une histoire courte, là, mais c'est des demandes en lien avec le respect de l'ancienneté sous le mouvement de main-d'œuvre, entre autres. Là. Beaucoup de demandes au niveau normatif, nouvelle convention collective à cause que c'est un nouvel entrepôt, puis beaucoup de demandes au niveau monétaire aussi, parce qu'on avait été acheté par Metro, puis on était en bas des conventions d'entrepôt de Metro. Fait que c'est ça.
OK. Fait que là, ça a mal commencé. Il y a eu un lockout, il y a eu des scabs. Peux-tu nous parler un peu de cette période-là, du conflit, puis où ça a débouché?
Oui. Ben, on a commencé à négocier dans la COVID. Fait que là, à un moment donné, ça a dû stopper parce que le mouvement syndical, on ne s'est pas reviré sur un dissent pour transformer toutes nos rencontres de négociation par Zoom. Là. C'est pas l'idéal. Là. Les hôtels étaient fermés, les restaurants étaient fermés. Parce que vous savez ce qui s'est passé au mois de mars, puis d'avril, puis de mai. Fait que ça n'a pas été évident. Fait que ça a ralenti la négociation qui a réellement démarré au mois de juin. Puis là, on a fait une assemblée générale, mais comme dans un ciné-parc. Là. Fait que pour maintenir les principes de distanciation sociale, puis on a fait un vote de grève à 99,6%, puis il y avait 550 personnes sur 650. Fait que ça a comme donné un coup de canon au départ de la négociation pour dire au boss qu'il fallait pas qu'il nous niaise trop longtemps. Puis là, on a réglé certains aspects au niveau du normatif, puis on a commencé à enclencher des moyens de pression, dont des moyens de pression lourds au courant de l'été. Puis finalement, il y a eu comme un climax, si on veut, là, au niveau de la négociation puis de la mobilisation aux alentours du mois d'octobre, je pense, peut-être début octobre, où est-ce que là, on a tenu une journée de grève au niveau du syndicat. Puis suite aux 24 heures de grève, malgré que l'employeur nous avait dit que ça ne se transformerait pas en lockout, bien, puis ça, j'étais là, sur la ligne de pitage, puis nous disait non, inquiétez-vous pas, demain matin, il n'y aura pas de lockout. Mais le lendemain matin, il y en a eu un lockout. Puis ça a duré 6 semaines. Puis, effectivement, il y a eu l'utilisation de scabs. À mon avis, minimum une centaine de scabs. Quand l'inspecteur a été là de jour, puis nous, on était là, le syndicat aussi, on avait 2 représentants. Selon nos calculs, il y en avait au moins 40. Là. Vous pouvez faire l'exercice sur de soir. Puis c'est ça. Puis là, il y a eu un rapport de l'inspecteur qu'on n'a jamais vu. Moi, je suis persuadé que c'est le ministre du Travail qui a mis la main là-dessus. Parce qu'on n'a jamais vu ce rapport-là. Puis là, on a négocié. Là, vous le savez, l'entente de principe a été adoptée à 78 %. Puis dans le protocole de retour au travail, bien là, on a effacé tous les recours juridiques de part et d'autre. On avait au-dessus d'une centaine d'arrestations de notre côté, deux travailleurs congédiés. Fait que le boss a effacé l'ardoise de ce côté-là. Puis nous, on a fait la même pour nos recours juridiques, entre autres sur les SCAB. Mais c'était indécent, là, l'utilisation du SCAB par métro dans ce dossier-là.
D'accord. Fait que quand on parle de l'entente de principe, ça a été accepté à 78 %, là, comme tu viens de dire. Ouais. Y a-t-il des grosses nouvelles là-dedans?
Ben, c'est moi, je pense que c'est la meilleure convention collective qu'on a signée en 35 ans. Là. Au niveau normatif, le résultat est exceptionnel. On a obtenu 98 % de ce qu'on demandait, on l'a obtenu. Fait que ça, c'est super bon. Au normatif, il n'y a aucune autre convention d'entrepôt, peu importe l'entreprise, qui a ce qu'on a. C'est sûr qu'au niveau monétaire, là, on n'a pas atteint tous nos objectifs. On voulait rattraper les entrepôts de métro, on ne l'a pas eu. Mais on a eu quand même des augmentations de salaire puis une augmentation du nombre de congés. On appelle ça stabilisateur, là, mais c'est des congés de maladie qui sont quand même substantiels. Fait que ça diminue l'écart, même si on ne les a pas rattrapés. Puis c'est une convention quand même pour le secteur privé de courte durée. C'est une convention de 5 ans, mais il y a déjà un an de fête. Fait que 4 ans, avant de recommencer à négocier puis de continuer à batailler ses salaires, c'est quand même pas mauvais. Fait que c'est un bon résultat.
D'accord. Fait que quand que tu viens de dire que là, vous avez 4 ans avec ce contrat-là, qu'est-ce que les gens ont appris? C'était quoi l'expérience des travailleurs et travailleuses? Puis qu'est-ce que tu penses qu'ils vont apporter à la prochaine négo?
Oui, bien, tu sais, avant le début du conflit, il y a eu, en fait, depuis 3 ans qu'il y a un nouveau centre de distribution, il y avait facilement au-dessus de 200 nouvelles personnes qui avaient été embauchées au centre de distribution, qui n'avaient jamais vécu un conflit, qui n'avaient jamais vécu... Nous, c'est notre troisième, Jean Coutu, là, un des années 90, un en 2002, lequel j'étais en 2002, là, comme travailleur et comme membre du syndicat. Puis celui-là, puis tu sais, il y avait beaucoup de craintes sur les 200 nouveaux, sur leur adhésion au mouvement, leur adhésion à la solidarité... sur les lignes de piquetage. Puis je pense que, je veux dire, une fois de plus, là, je veux dire, on vient de démontrer que c'est l'expérience syndicale qui forge la conscience syndicale. Parce que, tu sais, on avait travaillé fort là, pour enraciner les demandes, pour que les travailleurs comme, soient conscients du rapport de force qu'ils avaient à jouer pour obtenir leurs objectifs. Ils savaient c'est quoi qu'on demandait. Il y avait de la transparence constamment avec la table de négociation par les médias sociaux ou autre façon. Puis ben, les jeunes ont été à la hauteur du défi, là, puis de loin. Là. Fait que la relève est assurée. Là, je veux dire, il y a des... Tous ceux qui pensaient qu'ils étaient pour claquer des genoux là, d'un jeune, c'est pas ça qui s'est passé, mais pas du tout. Ils étaient extrêmement mobilisés puis solidaires, comme le restant du syndicat. Puis quand tu fais une négociation, puis tu vis un conflit, puis tu le fais correctement, ben c'est ça qui arrive.
Super. On parle, là, ce mois-ci, dans l'émission des travailleurs et travailleuses d'entrepôt en particulier. Tu parlais de modernisation, on parle de nouvelles entrepôts. Fait qu'est-ce que les gens doivent savoir au sujet des nouveaux entrepôts, puis qu'est-ce que ça veut dire pour, disons, la classe ouvrière en général, puis tout le secteur privé qui est en logistique?
Ouais. Bien, c'est sûr que les entrepôts hyper modernes, ça va faire qu'ils vont être capables de faire plus de volume avec moins de main-d'œuvre. T'sais, ils vont en avoir plus. Je dirais, tu sais, parce qu'il faut comprendre, là, même si on est rendu à 700 à l'entrepôt du groupe Jean Coutu, il y a aussi, tu sais, quand que Metro a acheté PJC, Metro détenait déjà les pharmacies Brunet, puis il y avait leur propre centre de distribution à Montréal qui employait environ 400 personnes. Puis il y en avait un autre plus petit, environ une cinquantaine à Québec. Fait que, tu sais, si on fait 150 plus 550, on ne sera pas 1200 à chez Jean Coutu, là. Ils vont peut-être engager 100 de plus à l'entrepôt du groupe Jean Coutu. Fait que, ce que ça fait, c'est que ça diminue le nombre de personnes qui ont besoin pour faire la job. Mais en ayant un entrepôt hyper moderne, hyper technologique, c'est plus difficile à opérer et à faire fonctionner. Fait que c'est sûr que ça rend plus problématique l'option au niveau de l'entreprise de dire bien, on va délocaliser dans une autre province. Comme qu'ils ont fait chez Provigo. Là. T'sais, Provigo, ils nous ont fermé Québec et envoyé ça en Ontario. Là, ils ont fait peur à tous leurs syndicats FTQ avec ça. Fait qu'ils ont négocié des gels de salaire. Puis ils ont fermé quand même, après avoir négocié des gels de salaire, l'entrepôt de Provigo à Laval, ils ont fermé quand même. Puis ils déménagent en Ontario, là, l'Oblast. Fait que, tu sais, quand t'as rien que des racking puis des lifts, là, c'est très simple à faire. Mais comme j'expliquais plus tôt, c'est tellement rendu robotisé, automatisé, quatrième révolution. tu peux pas jouer cette game-là comme ça quand tu as un entrepôt hyper moderne. Il y a une question de diversité des produits dans une pharmacie là aussi. Là, tu as moins de volume, mais tu as plus de produits différents que dans une épicerie. Fait que c'est ça.
La dernière question, David, c'est avec le conflit de Jean Coutu, il y a des sens dans les mouvements syndicaux, particulièrement dans la Fédération de commerce, l'échange dans les syndicats pour faire des actions, plus de conflits dans le secteur privé, pas accepter toutes les choses, toutes les affaires par les employeurs. C'est tout. Il y a des sens de l'échange dans le mouvement syndical, dans le secteur privé maintenant.
Oui. Mais c'est sûr que la fédération, notre objectif, c'est de changer la perception que les travailleurs ont à la grève. T'sais. On veut pas faire la grève pour faire la grève, mais faut pas démoniser ça non plus. Faut pas voir ça comme quelque chose de nécessairement négatif. C'est des travailleuses et des travailleurs, vous le savez, c'est notre seule façon à nous d'établir un rapport de force puis de pouvoir négocier d'égal à égal avec un employeur. C'est un outil qu'on se doit d'utiliser. Fait que si on pense que c'est de la merde puis ça vaut rien puis ça fait peur à tout le monde, je veux dire, on s'aide pas bien, là. Puis comme j'expliquais plus tôt, là, c'est par l'action collective qu'on fait des expériences syndicales qui forgent la conscience syndicale. Puis la grève puis la lutte, ben c'est peut-être le moyen le plus ultime de faire vivre une expérience collective à des travailleuses et des travailleurs pour qu'ils soient conscients de leur rapport de force. Fait que Faut, là où c'est nécessaire, là où on doit le faire, faut pas avoir peur de le faire. Fait qu'il faut pas en avoir honte. De la grève, faut même en être fier, même la valoriser.
D'accord. On va laisser ça comme c'est là. David, merci beaucoup d'avoir pris le temps aujourd'hui. On comprend que le conflit a presque de l'air terminé, mais que c'est pas tout à fait terminé non plus chez Jean Coutu. Fait qu'on va suivre ça. Puis bon courage, solidarité avec la suite. Là.
Ben, merci beaucoup. Salut, merci. Moustapha. Bye.
Salut, Stéphane. David. Merci beaucoup.
Bye-bye. Ciao.
Welcome to Labor Radio here on CQT 90.3 FM, and this has been a real honor. I am not live. I mean, I'm live, but not in person, but with Christian Smalls, an organizer, activist, who made global headlines during the early months of the pandemic in the effort to organize fellow Amazon workers out in New Jersey over health and safety conditions. Chris, you had been working at Amazon since 2015, and it just seems like now that you're not just active around taking on the world's largest company, but also around other issues, you know, that people are struggling with right now in terms of within the community and within the U.S. So thank you, Chris, for coming on Labor Radio.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Chris, if you can, so you had been working at Amazon from 2015 until 2020. And if you can just talk about, you know, because a lot of people, they get these outside views of Amazon and how it works. And but if you can talk a bit about your experience and sort of what led you to that moment to be like, enough's enough, that there's a red line and something's got to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, I started off entry level 2015. I came in as a regular warehouse level one warehouse associate. I was hired in probably one of the most physical departments of Amazon, the pick department, which is pretty much 10 hours of calisthenics for anybody that really wants to know what working conditions are like. Working in the pick department is definitely 10 hours of calisthenics here. You're walking up a ladder, you're bending, you're stretching, you're pulling. You're trying to do this in a timely manner. You're picking out hundreds of items an hour. These items come to you from a robot that has a big pod with bins on it. And the customer orders are on the screen. You pick it out. Your rate has got to be, I believe, it's $400 an hour now. When I got hired, it was $250. And I kind of like exceeded that because I came from a production warehouse prior to Amazon. So I kind of like, I want to say I was one of the pioneers of exceeding that rate of $250 and getting up to that $400 rate. And I was able to get promoted up to a process assistant, which is better known as a supervisor for that same department. And I was stuck in that position for the last 4 years. You know, systemically, Amazon doesn't like to put people of color on the same level as white management. And we all know that by their own numbers and percentages that they have out there. Over a million plus workers worldwide, and only 8% is either black or brown, or that's higher up as management. So that tells you right there the disproportionate of, you know, racial indifference that's in that company. The higher up the food chain, it's predominantly white. So, as a regular worker, an hourly associate, you definitely don't get treated the way you're supposed to be. You're treated as if you're just a number, because that's what you are when you work there. You are just a number that they need to complete their daily goal, be a part of their metrics. And if you don't meet that standard, you all know that Amazon's a high turnover company. They hire and fire all the time. So you are replaceable. Doesn't matter, you know, how long you've been there. As you know, I've been there almost 5 years. And before COVID even came into play, I was already pretty much mentally done. You know, I've been dealing with a lot of issues within the company. The fact that they wouldn't promote me, I applied for a salary manager position over 49 times, and I was denied in less than 2 years. The fact that, you know, I opened up three buildings for them, three major buildings in a tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And I still wasn't satisfied with my career growth at the time. And the fact that, you know, when COVID-19 came into play, they didn't listen to us. They didn't listen to us. They didn't hear my concerns. My concerns were concerns of everybody. Being a supervisor, it was my responsibility, I felt, to speak up for everybody. And it made it very easy for me to make a decision to take a stance against the company, because this was a life or death situation. This isn't in condition concern. When there's safety involved, we're talking about bringing home a deadly virus to your own community, to your family. So it made it pretty easy for me to make that decision.
Yeah, there's a few things along that line I want to ask you, because for you to, back to the turnover thing, because you to be there for 5 years is like being like a, like, you know, senior, it's like being like 30 years in any other job, because from, you know, stories that and things that are coming out more and more that, you know, Amazon will pay people a prime season bonus to get them to leave, right? Like, go to school, we'll pay your tuition, but don't ever come back here.
Yeah.
And so the idea that you've been there 5 years is one, remarkable, but two, if you could talk about why do they push so many people out the door so quick? Is it because the work is so physical, so they don't want them making complaints later on? Is it that they're afraid of people are going to start getting angry and organized? I mean, what is it that makes Amazon want to push people out so quickly?
It's not even so much that they want to push people out. It's the fact the way it's designed. That's the way their culture is designed. They don't take good care of the employees that are good workers. So the employees that are good workers, like myself, we hit that, what I like to say, we get burnt out. It's sort of like hitting a freshman wall. You know, you get into college and you're excited at first and you hit the ground running, and then you get to that point where it gets overwhelming. And then you're just ready to either, you know, look elsewhere, or you may not make it. You may withdraw, drop out, college drop out. Same thing with Amazon. You hit the ground running expecting all these expectations over the course of years. 2-3 years later, you realize you're still at level one, or you still ain't getting recognized for the hard work that you put in, and you're tired. You're like, I'm ready to get out of here. So you take that offer. They call it the offer when you get paid for $1,000 for every year that you've been there. And I think it maxed out at 5. So ironically, today, November 19th, would be my 5-year anniversary. If I was still employed, I would have made 5 years and been able to take a $5,000 buyout. But as you mentioned, I would have never been able to work for Amazon or any of its subsidiaries ever again in my lifetime. That's the only downplay to it. And we all know that $5,000 is getting taxed. So
it's not $5,000.
That's the catch. They don't tell you that. They make it seem like, you know, you get these bonuses, but every bonus you get with Amazon gets taxed. Something that Jeff Bezos doesn't pay, by the way.
Yeah, so he doesn't get taxed.
You get taxed more than your own CEO, out of your own paycheck. And once again, it's not the fact that Amazon wants to push you out. It's the way the system is designed. You can be a hard worker. You could be a great employee. But if you, after years and years of putting in that work and you don't get anywhere, you are going to quit. Or once again, you're going to get fired because you're going to give up on trying to be a model employee. And as soon as you switch off, they have the right to target you. Especially if you're speaking up, somebody like me that would speak up or have a backbone, you don't fit that culture. They want people that's going to listen to them all the time, do exactly what the company needs. That's how they put profits above people.
And just back to the early days of the pandemic, you know, and so much in, like, even the warehouses that we work with, and thinking about the neighborhoods and communities that were the most affected by the pandemic, right? Like, this deadly virus wasn't affecting all people equal. You know, you were white, you were teleworking. If you were black and brown, you know, you had to go to the warehouse. I had one worker tell me that, I wish I wasn't essential. I don't want to go to work. I want to stay home like those other folk. And these warehouses are, you know, giant, badly ventilated, open air. So if you can talk about, and New York was the epicenter, you know, globally. It wasn't just like, you know, in the U.S., but globally was New York City. So, in being in like a, you know, what were the conditions inside the warehouse during the pandemic and like the early days of the pandemic and you know, in terms of health and safety, staggering shifts, did they care? Did they not care? You know, like, because clearly that must have, to go into work every day must have been the most scariest, you know, event, you know, for anybody who had to work during those moments.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was scary in the beginning. We didn't have anything. We didn't have any PPE, didn't have no facial masks, didn't have no cleaning supplies, didn't have any safety guidelines or enforcement. We were actually having parties in the middle of the epicenter. In my facility, JFDA, Staten Island, a facility that has 5,000 people that reports to this building, one of the biggest buildings in the Amazon network. 5,000 people from all five boroughs of New York and New Jersey attended the building. And we had parties in the middle of March while people were dying every 15 minutes from COVID. That's the scariest thing. People were positive, getting sick on a daily basis. And the company was behind the ball. If I didn't speak up, who knows how long we would have been unprotected. If I didn't do what I did to get fired, and I didn't even mean to get fired. All I did was try to raise concerns about, you know, once again, simple stuff. Health and safety, protecting ourselves, protecting my employees. We're only asking for simple demands efforts. Close the building down, clean it, sanitize it professionally, we come back to work. That's all we wanted. You know, we wanted to be safe. People had underlying health conditions. Women had children. Infant babies, some were pregnant themselves. You know, they wanted just simple, basic needs. Clean up, we come back to work. Shut down for a minimum 14 days for the 14-day incubation period. We come back to work. Give us extensive health care, you know, paid health leave or $2 hazard pay permanently. Simple things. Paid time off. They didn't want to give us anything. So, you know, you had to apply for the Amazon Relief Fund, which you only got it if you contracted the virus, you know. So it was way too much of the company putting its business over our own essential health. Our health is essential. And I understand when people say they don't want to be an essential worker because the government deemed us that. We didn't ask to be essential workers. This essential workers started trending in 2020 all of a sudden. You know, essential workers have been around forever. But all of a sudden, we are the lifeline of the country. We are the Red Cross. We are the angels of the, we're this, that, and the third. But we're not humans anymore. We forgot about that. It's the fact that we are deemed essential workers. We don't have a choice. We don't have a choice. This is our career. So if we're essential, that means that we're a necessity. And if you need me, that means you need to take care of me. And that's what essential workers got to realize, your value. You got to realize that your CEO, Jeff Bezos, is not coming to the warehouse and packing 1,000 boxes a day. That is you. You have more value than Jeff Bezos. So you need to understand when it's time to speak up and you need to shut stuff down, shut it down. We all need to come together and we need to decide on what we're doing, whether we're unionizing. Are we organizing? Are we want some type of rank and file committee? The time is now.
And can you talk about the walkout that led to your being firing? And maybe after that, can just one last question in terms of what's happening now and what's happening. And you know, are you in touch with other Amazon workers? Are people looking to you for inspiration on how to organize in these warehouses? But what happened to, you know, the organizing the walkout?
Yeah, I spent the entire week off the clock on my own free will in the building, pretty much telling all the workers the truth. But management told me not to tell any of the employees that somebody tested positive. I couldn't stand with that. So after doing that for an entire week, from March 24th to the day they put me on quarantine. Yeah, by the way, they put me on quarantine. I was one of the probably out of 5,000 people, I was the third person to be quarantined when I didn't even have the virus. And the person I sent home, my colleague who I worked hand in hand with, who was a supervisor as well, who is a supervisor, correction, she had the virus for multiple days in a row. She tested positive. And thank God that I sent her home the day I seen her, because she was sick. And they decided to just quarantine me. Nobody else, not even the person I ride to work with. Nobody else in my department. We're talking about hundreds of people. So I knew I was being targeted to be silent so that I could stop organizing workers and telling them the truth. So I broke that quarantine, and I did a protest on March 30th outside of the facility, a walkout around 12:30. And that's when my life changed forever. You know, the world fell into my lap with the media worldwide, you know, was viral. And then 2 hours later after that protest, I was terminated by the company. And it didn't stop there. A week later, Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world himself, had a meeting about me. He spent $9 million. This man makes $4,000 a second, $9 million an hour. He had a meeting about trying to run a smear campaign on me to calling me not smart or articulate with his top general counsel, David Sapolsky, pretty much to put to be in a better PR position than to worry about the health and safety concerns of their own employee workforce. So that tells you right there that even the richest man in the world will try to crush the man that the employee's at the bottom, you know, somebody who's just an hourly associate. So that's pretty much how, you know, I came into the media spotlight that I have today. But I didn't, you know, I didn't pretty much fade to black. I use this platform to uplift the voices of those that are scared to speak up, organizing workers till this day, collectively, building the movement. We've seen multiple walkouts throughout the course of the pandemic and here in the States, and not here in the States, all over the world, even in, you know, the UK and Germany and Italy and France. So this is a sort of like a revolution for the labor movement as well. And I'm just happy to be a part of it and continue to fight this fight.
Thank you, Chris. And maybe, sorry, one last thing, because, you know, this is something that we try to push and we talk about, you know, and, you know, I feel like you're in the midst of two movements because, you know, thinking about a revolution in the labor movement, but bringing the ideas of like Black Lives Matter and anti-racism within that, you know, that like, you know, you look at companies like Amazon or you look at these warehouses and just thinking about that, you know, that the power that, you know, Black and brown people have, you know, can stop the richest man in the world or can make him, you know, and just thinking about how we fight and challenge systemic racism now through the labor movement and also getting the labor movement to think about these issues too. I don't know if you think about it or thought about it at all, you know, in the course of your own, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been combining, even at my demonstration, all the movements, the labor movement, the social injustice movement, and the environmental movement, global warming as well. That's what we need to do right now. We need to combine all these movements. So you see me protesting with Black Lives Matter. You see me, I put on the whole demonstration for Breonna Taylor. I've been out protesting with the nurses and doctors. I protested with the bus drivers. I protested with the environmental groups like Extinction Rebellion about global warming. I protested with teachers, students, anybody.
It's not about just the labor movement by itself. We need all these movements to come together to take on Goliath, you know, David versus Goliath, but we all have to be David. So that's what I'm about. I'm always about solidarity. And we're talking about true solidarity. That means, you know, we work together with any movement. And that's how we take it. We take down the, you know, the oligarchy, the biggest 1%ers in the world, the CEOs that don't care about us, that are not a part of our communities, the black and brown, indigenous, immigrant, no matter what color or creed you're from. It's our time to utilize real people's power and combine these movements. And that's what you're going to see at all my demonstrations. I have another one coming up, and I will be combining, once again, social injustice, environmental, and labor.
Oh my God, thank you so much, Chris. You've been a real inspiration, and like once this is over, we got to bring you up to Montreal. Well,
I'm coming.
And how can people follow you? Because on social media, and how can they get in touch with what you're doing and follow what you're doing?
Absolutely, yeah. On Twitter, shut_down Amazon. No surprise there. On Instagram, chris.smalls_. We have my website, tcow.org. Follow us on Twitter at TCOEW, Instagram at TCOEW, Facebook as well, the Congress of Essential Workers.
Thank you so much, Chris, for being on Labor Radio today.
Absolutely. Anytime. Take care.
Take care. You've been listening to Labor Radio here on CKT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Mustafa Henaway, co-host with
Stefan Doucet. Thanks for listening to the show. Just a few announcements before we let you go. Things to watch out for. So the Communist Party of Canada is launching a campaign on EI reform. Obviously, it's very necessary in this pandemic time and high unemployment and whatnot. Mustafa, you have a few other ones?
Yeah, so also the Immigrant Workers Center is relaunching Coalition Against Precarious Work, which brings together temporary foreign workers, undocumented workers, temp agency workers in warehouses. And the relaunching of the coalition is to demand better health and safety protection for precarious workers, and sort of challenge some of the things in the law, and also to fight around regularization for essential workers. So
definitely bring you that, and that's going to be happening in December the 12th around International Human Rights Day. Also, stay tuned on our December show for that interview on the general strike that's going to take place in India in a few weeks. So come back and stay tuned in December. Anything else to add, Stefan?
Well, just we're going to be launching a Facebook page soon where you'll be able to catch some of our interviews that happen sort of outside of the context of the once monthly show. But otherwise, we'll catch you on December 17th for our December show, and looking forward to talking to you then.
And that's it for Labor Radio, third Thursday of every month here on Off the Hour on CQT 90.3 FM.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. What? Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
CKUT
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on November 19th, 2020. On tonight's show, my guests, Sophie G and Shadia Kikonjo of Habibi's Angels commission Impossible on the many complications about creating a show about diversity.
We want
to be able to talk about everything. We don't just want to talk about like our cultural identity. Like, that's not what we think about 24/7.
Dancer Heather Ma on recreating her grandmother's life story in Pomegranate, her first major solo show at the age of 60.
What I find the most fascinating is it comes back to me. What is different, of course, when I was creating it, it's not like when you're 20 is where I want to repeat something for 3 hours in rehearsal. So I get to what my body can do. I find what my body can do and how much my energy can give. And I really work with that.
And Mainline's Kenny Struli taking his story of growing up in the country to the actual farm.
For me, it was